Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book I do the review, stick it up online for everyone to download, listen to it, hopefully enjoy, you know the kind of deal here. So, not a lot of news, Christmas is gone, and when I last left you I was in, I think in Rome, no, in somewhere in Italy anyway, and uploaded a podcast, and I mentioned at the end of it that the audiobook that I was listening to was a book by Christopher Priest called The Prestige, and I thought, well, I'm not quite sure if this is science fiction, not quite sure if it's fantasy, not quite sure if it's the kind of thing that would go in here. I mentioned that on goodreads.com as well, and some people said, well, you know, just treat it as steampunk or something like that, and I reckon it'll fit in. So and I got an email about it as well, and I thought, okay, well, I'll do the review, but it's going to be very, very tricky to review this, because this this novel is made into a movie. And again, it's one of those times where you go, well, how much of the novel is being influenced by the movie, and how much shall I mention, that kind of thing. But also, there's a big problem, and that is that this book is very difficult to talk about the novel, because the movie itself, because it's got a twist in it, it's playing a trick on your mind game on you, and the spoiler for the movie is at the beginning of the book, or you can work out from the beginning of the novel quite easily. I say the beginning, maybe in the first third of the novel, you'll be able to work out what the twist is at the end of the movie quite easily, and then you find out in the movie what the spoiler is at the things that happens at the end of this book, which is a spoiler. So it's really, really weird that the end of the movie spoils the beginning of the book, and the beginning of the book spoils the end of the movie, but like, because they're doing like the opposite reveal, or they're doing a different reveal each time, even though they're telling basically the same story, because they're set up differently. That's the way it works. So just to explain a little bit about the story itself, and then I'll get on to how I'm going to review this, which is going to be like a different kind of thing. So this book, actually, let me just quickly bring up here the Goodreads.com page about it. So it's 404 pages. It was published in 1995, and it won the the literary awards. It says it's here. There's an Arthur C. Clarke nominee award, the World Fantasy Award for best novel. I think it won that one, or maybe let me open up the Wikipedia page. I could probably find out more about it here as well. It was the World Fantasy Award winner for 1996. So they're classing it as fantasy. Arthur C. Clarke is science fiction, you see. But when you first start reading the book, and actually when you first start watching the movie, you're not quite sure what kind of thing it is, because it's a story. It's set in like 1890 through to about 1902, 1903 ish. So sort of like very like late Victorian era. Most of the action takes place in London and in theatres in seaside resort towns around England. And it goes, it's about, pretty much tells the story of a rivalry between two magicians, and the rivalry kicks off when one of them, when they're both quite young, one of them is like, oh, I'm going to be I'm going to be doing spiritualist thing, I'm going to do seances, and the other guy is going, well, no, you're tricking people who are, you know, are vulnerable and have just lost a loved one, and you're getting their money for them, and you're doing this, you're just doing trickery, you're just doing magic, so I'm going to go in and ruin one of your seances. So Alfred Borden, who is sort of like a young working class background magician, he goes in and disrupts that, and the other guy, Rupert Angier, who is, say, you know, he's presented as the more upper class kind of guy, more classy guy, he doesn't take that kindly, and even though Alfred Borden apologizes, the feud begins, and we're not quite sure why they're taking it so seriously, but throughout there, like, as it says, tells about 15 years, I guess, of recounting of their careers from when they're young magicians, going through until they're quite famous, you know, top to the top of the game. They're kind of like, but one of them is the top magician in London, and then the other one is the top magician in London, and the other one comes up with a new trick, and he's then the top magician. And they're always trying to kind of disrupt each other's shows and trying to discover each other's secrets. And like one of the main themes of the, certainly more in the movie actually, is about them disrupting each other's shows. You're always seeing them, like one of them will try and sneak backstage at the other one, and the other one will get up on stage. And a lot of this plays out in the book, although in the book it's a lot more about not just wanting to disrupt the other guy, but to kind of like just outdo them in every way, in terms of life, in terms of money, in terms of fame, in terms of everything like that. And it becomes this driving obsession between the two of them. At different times, one of them is more obsessed than the other one. The other is like, right, no, I'm not gonna respond. That's it. I'm not gonna do anything more. And then he get pushed over the edge, and he will respond. And then another time, the other guy's going, well, no, I don't want to do this. I'm not really too bothered about this rivalry. And then he comes back, and the rivalry is sparked anew. So that's kind of like the basic setup of the story. And again, what goes on, I don't really want to mention too much, but it's about, you know, trying to find each other's secrets. One of them has a transported man trick where he disappears from one side of the stage and appears on the other. And all the time, the other guy is trying to work out how it's done. And then once he works out how it's done, or he works out a different method, then the other guy is going, well, I need to work out how he did it as well. So that's one of the main driving forces, is this transported man trick, and then the new transported man trick. And the book is told from the point of view, or the framing story is the the distant descendants. Like, it's the great-great-granddaughter, it's the great-granddaughter and the great-grandson of Borden and Angier, Rupert Borden and Alfred Borden. And they get together, and the granddaughter of one of them is like, right, I want to tell you, I want to get to the bottom of this. Our parents tried to get to the bottom of this, and our grandparents tried to get to the bottom of this. Every generation, there's another meeting of the descendants of these two things, and somehow it's not so much a rivalry is kicked off again, but something happens to sort of like renew the interest and renew the mystery, and nobody's really quite sure what's going on about it. So one of them gets out the memoir. Oh, no, the memoir of Borden was kind of like a journal, and it was him talking about his ideas about magic and about the development of his act and the development and his study of the other ones, and also his quest to discover Angier's transporting man trick. And so that's a well-known book, and it's actually they have a copy of this book, which was published in a small batch, a very expensive hobby is collecting magic books, because they would print like 50 at a time or 70 at a time, and there were 70 of these published. And there's notes on this memoir by Angier himself, talking about, you know, expanding it and describing the tricks, and it's like a textbook on magic, told from the point of view of a journal. And then we get a recounting, like the first half of this novel is a recounting of this story told from Borden's point of view. And then we switch back to the great granddaughter and the great grandson, and we get a bit more of their story and a bit about what they were doing as children. And then it goes on to the memoir, the journal of the other guy, of Angier, Rupert Angier, and he goes all the way back to when he's like 14 or something, and about him first seeing like a magician and him learning his craft. And for me, this was not the more interesting, it was more of a straight telling, you know, it was less experimental, but it was, you know, still journal, and he's keeping stuff from himself, and well, not from himself, but from the reader, and keeping, you know, because he doesn't, you know, he's trying to make sure that nobody discovers this journal, and it's kind of nobody does. It's not actually quite made sure, made clear in the story if this journal, when he completed it and hid it, if it was ever found again. That's not really made clear, or if it's going to be found after this framing story is finished. And then at the end, once we get to the end of that journal by Angier, we get like another bit more of the framing story, which like ties up all of the mysteries that have been hinted at all the way through this. And then they are. So like I say, first you get the story from one point of view, and it's about one guy trying to find the signature of the other guy. And then you get it from the point of view of the other guy trying to find out the secrets from the other. And what I really love about this telling is that they're both, I wouldn't say they're both unreliable narrators, but they both put their own spins on it because they don't know that each other is keeping a diary of the event. So when we see the incident which sparks it all off, where Borden disrupts this seance, you're like, oh, well, that was okay. That wasn't too bad. And you think like that, and then you see it from the other guy's point of view, and you're like, oh, right. And then you see another thing, because they're disrupting each other's shows, one of them doesn't even mention the time that he disrupted the other show, because for him it was just one of many times. And then when the other guy writes about the same incident, he's like, oh, and this happened, and it was a massive life-changing event. And yet the other guy doesn't even know how much, well, he knows he's trying to have an impact on him, but he doesn't realize which actions of his is having the main impact on the other. And I really love this, this storytelling device, that you think you got the whole story, even though you know you've not got the whole story, and then you get it from the other point of view, and then you think you've got the whole story, even though you know you've not got it, but it enlightens other parts in this. So I think that's pretty much all I can talk about now about the novel. And about the movie, again, it's pretty much the same kind of framework. One of them, it's told like in this flashback kind of framing story, and one of them is reading the journal. I think it's in the movie. It's in a cipher. It's in a code. So as he's going through the story, it's going through the journal of the other. He's reading it, and I do actually think there's an extra step that they take in the movie, which I think is cleverer than the book. But because the book is different, and I read the book second, I was thinking, well, is that going to be the way it works out? But there's so much more. There's so many more layers in the book. In the movie, you've only got, 2 hours or something to tell the full story and get across the twists and tell it from two point of views at the same time and get in all these other, these love interests and these other things like that. That the book is, the movie is very, very compressed. There's not a lot of, the depth, or they're not the same level of depth. It's like, this guy has got an obsession of this other guy, and this other guy has got an obsession of this guy. And in the movie, I think the genius to the end of the movie is that you're always thinking, right, who's going to win? Who's going to win at the end of this? And you're like, and as the end of the movie approaches, you're like, oh, this guy's winning. And then you go, oh, no, this guy's winning. Oh, this guy's winning. No, the other guy's winning. Oh, this guy's really lost. Oh, no, he hasn't lost. And I think that's continual switching back between, like, who is protagonist, who is antagonist, who is the good guy, who is the bad guy, who is the winner, who is the loser, and the resolution, or even lack of resolution, that the end of the movie hints at, I think is really, really great, that even though these guys are literally killing each other by the end of the movie, and by the end of the book, death is a big point of in both the movie and the book. By the time they're plotting to kill each other, and one of them, the movie starts with one of them in jail and things, which is and I don't want to give it away, but different from the book. You're really wondering, like, wow, how are they going to get out of this? Anyway, so the reason why I don't want to go in any more about spoilers, and I've got something to say more about spoilers, is that the whole point of this book and of the movie is that they're constructed as magic tricks, and both of them state very clearly that is what they're doing. They say, we got the setup, we've got the performance, and then we've got the prestige, which I think is just something that Christopher Priest made up. It's just some magic terminology that he made up and put into the words of Borden, and then you're not quite sure, what is Borden... Does Angier know the what Borden is saying, or is that common parlance of the time? Is it the common lingo? But the idea being that you got the setup, you talk about the trees, you got the performance when you're actually doing the trick, and then the prestige is the reveal of the trick. So if something is moving from one place to the other, the prestige is it appearing in that other place. Which I quite like that breakdown of the magic trick. And the book is done in that way that you get the setup, which is the one story told from one point of view. You've got the performance, which is like literally talking about the performance, much more about the performance from the other point of view of the other magician. And then you've got like the frame story, which is kind of the prestige, which is also split into three parts, which with a setup, the performance, and then the reveal, and then that last part of the frame story that I think it's called part five. The few chapters there at the end is the reveal of the secret, or the reveal of the thing that is that represents the performance and the setup of the trick. Excuse me, glass of water here. So that's very important, and that's why I think in this case, the order that you watch this, I really do recommend that you watch the movie first. If you're going to watch either, watch the movie first and then read the book. And I'll get onto why in a second, but first I want to read about, I wrote something about spoilers, and people often ask me, oh, what about spoilers? Why do you care about spoilers? Why don't you spoil books? And I wrote about it on my blog, and I think I'll just actually read out why I avoid spoilers. And this is, again, I first posted this on the blog, I guess this is maybe a slightly later version, and if I need to expand on anything, I will. But this pretty much wraps up like four of the main points of why I avoid spoilers. So it goes like this. Part one is the introduction is emotions. My definition of art is something created by a human agency with the intention of eliciting an emotional response from the viewer, the reader, the listener, participant, etc. This isn't an unassailable definition, but as an artist and as a professional entertainer and performer, it's a pretty handy guide. It also lets me enjoy art when it comes my way. What is important to understand is that the emotional response doesn't have to be a single kind or even a positive kind. Joy and laughter is what most comedians aim for, but if all you get is laughs, there's not much about it that will stick with you in the long term. That's why comedians try to bring out other emotional responses. And comedies, movies do the same thing. Romantic comedies want you to feel warm and fuzzy. Other comedies want you to feel uncomfortable, so they put in gross-out scenes. One of the strongest emotional responses I've had from a comedy recently, I wrote this earlier this year, a comedy recently was watching Bridesmaids, and one scene in particular in which two bridesmaids are trying to outdo each other with speeches about the bride had me cringing. I literally had to stop the movie for a few minutes to let myself calm down. It was awesome. Other comedies like Groundhog Day bring the laughs, but also bring about a sense of pathos and even a sense of dread that makes you think about the futility of life. That, by the end, you're full of compassion and hope for the future is the genius of the movie Groundhog Day and why it's considered a classic. And that's why I've written a whole musical this year based on Groundhog Day, because I wanted to kind of wrap that up. Getting back to this essay, this all seems pretty obvious. And knowing what is going to happen in advance in most comedies isn't going to spoil much of your enjoyment. And in a comedy like Groundhog Day, it can actually heighten your enjoyment because, you know, you get the whole dramatic irony as you go through. However, there are a few emotions that fiction is no longer able to instill if you know what is coming. Emotional response number one, surprise. The most obvious is surprise. This is the easiest for movies to do. And when it's well done is the least susceptible to spoilers. The movie Final Destination, the first one, had trailers with scenes not from the movie itself, but featuring audience members jumping out of their seats while watching the movie for the first time. I knew it was a movie about people living longer than they should and death catching up with them one by one. Also, before seeing the movie, I'd heard conversations where people said, "Holy shit, the scene with the bus is amazing." And I was thinking, oh, great, it's spoiled. I thought, now I won't be surprised. All I have to do is watch out for a bus. And then when I see a bus coming, I can get ready for... And if you've seen Final Destination, number one, you'll know just how unprepared I was for the death involving the bus. Even me telling you a bus is involved in one of the deaths isn't going to spoil it for you because it is so surprising. And that is the genius of the movie and why there are now a whole slew of sequels, none of which I've had any urge to watch. The only way to spoil that individual scene is to have watched the movie at least once before, or in this case, to have watched that scene before, which is why the trailer for the movie never showed that scene at all. Unfortunately, many movie distributors aren't as kind nor as clever as those who marketed Final Destination. They include all kinds of otherwise surprising things in their movie trailers, which is why I avoid trailers. If I hear a movie is good, I'll probably get around to watching it eventually. I take a lot of long flights, so I can fit in a few movies while traveling backwards and forwards across oceans. And on cruise ships where I work, there's always like recent releases playing, and I catch up with lots of movies back home on DVD. But I do try to avoid spoilers where I can for this reason. The second emotion is shock. And I love to be shocked by fiction. Characters are going about their lives or when they're on an adventure and suddenly something happens or something is revealed and everything changes. And this could be for the good and it can also be for the worst, and it's far better if it is for the worst. Unfortunately, unlike a good surprise, a shock can be spoiled if you know what is going to be revealed. Or more to the point, if you understand what is going to be revealed. And the difference here is subtle. For example, my name is Luke. So throughout life, I've, you know, put up with people telling me, use the force, and also telling me they were my father. And normally with a deep voice and with heavy breathing, Luke, I am your father. Now, before I ever saw The Empire Strikes Back, or consciously saw it, like sit down to watch it and really understand what was going on, people would tell me that they were my father. They'd say, Luke, I am your father. And I understood it was like a Star Wars reference, because why else would they be, you know, referencing Luke and Luke Skywalker, because I've grown up with that. But I didn't really understand what they meant, like what they really meant. I'd grown up with Star Wars, of course, but Empire Strikes Back wasn't shown on TV in the UK until maybe the mid-80s or something, and then only at Christmas. So it was a while as a child where I knew Star Wars and had seen Star Wars, but hadn't caught up with Empire Strikes Back. And then probably, I'm thinking, maybe 6 or 7, maybe 8 or something like that, I watched Empire Strikes Back for the first time, and suddenly I was like, holy shit. Well, it wasn't like that because, you know, I probably didn't even know what the word shit meant at that point. But I was just like, oh, I am your father. I am your father. And then, like, I was totally shocked by it, even though I knew, I'd heard that quote all my life, being called Luke and growing up in the 80s, and my sister is called Leia, although I didn't know that they were brother and sister either. Spoilers. Either there. And, you know, and I'm a twin as well, you know. So there's so much that I have in common with Luke Skywalker, you know, you know, if you're talking about commonalities in that way, and the reason why people would say, hey, Luke, I am your father. And I'm not a stupid kid. And so, you know, but I had heard something, but I didn't work out why. I didn't understand what was going on. And if I did understand what the shocking reveal would be, you know, it would have spoiled the movie for me. I wouldn't have had that shock. And I think that's another reason why the prequels don't work if you watch them, like, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You shouldn't do it that way around, because you're taking away that shock, that emotion, that possible emotional response, and replacing it with very bad emotional response. Years ago, I watched the first few seasons of Dexter, up to the end of season 3. And everyone said, season 4 is the best, and the ending is such a shock. But they were always sensitive. They would never spoil it, and I'm really thankful for that. And I avoided learning anything about Dexter season 4 at all. And I only kept up with any like discussion up to season 3, and then kind of left the discussion if it was online, or just stopped taking part in it, or, you know, ask for no spoilers, and people understood not to do that. And then earlier this year, over the course of a few months, I rewatched the first 3 seasons along with my girlfriend Juliana, and I joined them all again, but in a different way. This time I found it a fun experience to see my girlfriend having all of the surprising and shocking events played out in front of her, and I enjoyed it vicariously through her. And then we got to season 4 and everything was new for me. And then we reached the last scene of that last episode of season 4. And I knew a shock was coming, but I didn't know what. And as it turned out, it was way more shocking than anything I'd thought up, and way more shocking than anything my girlfriend had thought up, or anything that we both kind of shared and were like, oh, I wonder if this had happened. You know, we wanted the characters to be, shake things up for the characters involved. And it was so shocking that we had to put on the first episode of season 5 immediately, just to make sure that it wasn't a dream sequence or like a trick by the show producers. And that shock stayed with me. I had trouble sleeping that night and for the next few nights as I imagined something similar to what happened to Dexter happening in my own life. And I really, really loved that. It felt glorious. A TV show could make me feel something so visceral. And it's one of those peak experiences that I crave. And it doesn't happen very often with TVs and in movies, and I cherish it when it does happen, and so I avoid spoilers because I want to have these experiences again in the future. Getting on to the final section, the twist, part 1. The final reason I like to avoid spoilers and try not to spoil things for other people is that I like to be made to feel stupid. On the other hand, I like to be made to feel intelligent, starting off with stupidity. Great works of TV and film can stand up to repeat viewing, even if there is a twist ending. A twist can be shocking or surprising, but it also works on an intellectual level. Aiming to affect someone intellectually can be part of a work of art, but if that is the sole reason, for me it falls more into the category of lesson, teaching material, political propaganda, and all that kind of stuff. However, clever artists use the intellect of the viewer or listener to move their emotions. So the twist is different to the shock. It relies on the viewer having come to one conclusion and then the narrative exposing that conclusion as false and revealing another conclusion that fits all the presented facts and also explains many more. So it's like a paradigm shift. This is different to my example before with Darth Vader saying, "Luke, I am your father." Because there wasn't any expectation that there was a relationship there in the first place. That's why it's a shock and not a twist. So an effective twist can elicit two distinct responses. The first is, "Oh, I'm really stupid. I should have seen all this, but I was totally blind." So to bring up a good example is the Sixth Sense. It seems that 95% of the people had the same response. "I'm so stupid." And everyone loved being made to feel stupid, being tricked. When you knowingly participate with the tricker, feels really good. This is why people enjoy magic shows. They know magic is bullshit and that the performer is using tricks and mirrors and magnets, but they love the feeling of being fooled. This is a big theme in The Prestige, which I'll get to in a bit. My experience with The Sixth Sense was different. Before watching it, two girls had a very loud conversation right next to me and blatantly explained the twist ending and covered many of the relevant points along the way. And they did all this before I understood that they were talking about The Sixth Sense. And then when I cottoned on, I just groaned. I was like, oh no. And that was a crowded place as well. Loads of other people were around. I couldn't believe they would have such a loud conversation publicly. It was in the computer room at university, so there was lots of people sitting there listening probably. And then I went to see the movie at the cinema, and I enjoyed the movie, and I jumped at some of the shocks, and liked some of the surprises, but the twist had very little effect on me. Some of the tricks that were used to do that passed me by, but I caught many of the others. Even as I was trying to put that explained twist out of my mind, I thought, well, I'll try not to think about that while I'm watching the movie and see if I can still be surprised, see if it can still make me feel stupid, but I didn't. I was robbed of that feeling stupid. Oh, phone call, 1 second. It is now 2 hours later, but I will continue, see if I can pick up my train of thought from before. So I was reading this this essay that I'd put to my blog. So I was robbed of the feeling that I was stupid, and knowing the twist spoiled that element that I could have otherwise enjoyed. Thankfully, there are plenty more twists that make me feel stupid in other movies. The Prestige worked great for me in that case and on so many levels, because all the way through the movie, they're telling you that you're being tricked and explaining the trick right in front of your eyes, and you still miss it. Or at least I did. And if you worked out the twist without knowing it in advance, well, that's the last reason I like to avoid spoilers. The twist part 2, intelligence. I like to work things out for myself. Making people feel intelligent is the opposite reaction to a good twist. And by intelligent, I mean the combination of mental ability and relevant knowledge or experience. If everyone guesses the twist ending, it's not really a twist. If nobody guesses the twist ending, it probably comes too much out of nowhere or isn't set up properly, and this falls into the shock category. However, if between 80-90% of people are surprised by the twist and 10-20% of people say, "Oh, I worked it out from this and this and this," you've probably done a good job with your book or movie. And for the 20% of people who worked out, they feel clever. They know that they've used their intellect as the artist hoped, and they are rewarded by the artist by the feeling of superiority over the other 80%, even if that superiority is only knowing just a little bit more about a specific trivial thing. As much as I like being in the 80% of people who get the satisfaction of being tricked by a twist, I just as much enjoy working out the twist before it arrives myself. Who knows? If I'd have had this same kind of enjoyment with The Sixth Sense, maybe. I do know that when I watched Unbreakable, I did work out the twist, although I admit I fell asleep before the end and then had to wind back to see if I was right or not. And I guess the twist in The Village too, though I think that movie was designed so it didn't rely on the twist as much as M. Night Shyamalan's movies, other movies did. I like being tricked by muses. By movies, but if I was tricked every time, it might get tiresome. Twists becoming tiresome is why I understand some people don't like being made to feel stupid by a movie. For these people, if it is spoiled for them, they don't have to worry about it anymore. I also suspect that many people who already know a twist like to tell themselves that if they didn't already know it, they would have worked it out for themselves in advance. To be honest, many of the twists I know in advance seem trivial to work out, but then how can I be the judge of that? The only way to really test my intelligence is to go in not knowing and see how the chips fall. So there you have it. That is why I avoid spoilers. I like to be surprised, to be shocked, to be made to feel stupid, and to be made to feel intelligent. As an artist, these emotional responses are just some of the wide range I like to elicit myself, and as a reviewer, they are experience I like to leave open as options for my listeners to enjoy. So, there you go, that's the full article. Actually, it's slightly expanded as I was going through with my own speaking there during this recording. Spoilers. I like to leave, like I said, there. I like to leave the options, the full range of emotions that can be experienced from a movie open to myself. So, like I'm saying, I reckon if you watch the movie of The Prestige first, you'll get many, many layers of these different twists. You'll be shocked in places and surprised in some places. You'll be made to feel clever in some places, like I was with the movie. And also, in other ways, you'll be made to feel stupid. But then, if you then read the book like I did, then you will still be you'll still feel stupid because the book does tell a different story. It's set in a slightly different world. The twists are slightly different, and in some ways the movie does more than the book, and in some ways the movie does less. But then, like, the two main sequences, like how the specific tricks are done, is I wouldn't say identical to how it is in the movie, because the movie doesn't really go into it. It doesn't really show it, doesn't explain it that well, and the book does explain it in a bit more details. However, both of the magicians in their texts, in their journals, in their memoirs, actually are not writing the full explanation. They're both keeping stuff back from you as a reader. So it's only when you read the two of them together do you understand exactly what's going on. And then with the frame story, and when you get to part five, where it really explains what's going on with both sides, do you totally understand? And there's some absolutely amazing misdirection in that opening section, because he's like, you know, talking about, oh, it's what's, you know, I've got an identical twin. I'm sure I did. And it was, are you sure you had an identical twin? I've got a twin. So that part of the book really appealed to me, and yet I don't want to say that's misdirection or not misdirection, but both of these characters do, and the characters in the frame story do talk about identical twins and things like that. As an identical twin myself, that really appealed to me in the book, that is. But because you know parts of the book, you know, like before you've read the book, you can appreciate it. Now, this is something, again, that's mentioned within the book itself. Borden, who, you know, is the first memoir that you write, that you read, he's saying, well, when you see someone doing the linking rings trick, the linking rings trick goes back thousands of years, and people have been doing it for a long, long time, like performing it in many different ways. So even myself as a magician, when I see someone do the linking rings trick, it's not about the secret. It's not about not knowing the twist. I mean, I'm using my own words here, but it's not about the twist. It's not about the surprise. It's not about the shock. You know all of the steps, you know, and if you've seen the linking rings, you know, and the cup and balls, you've seen the effect before. You've seen it many, many times. And the genius then in the performer is to make it interesting, is to do it really well, to do the best performance possible. And if something is of that quality, they will bring out different aspects of something that even if you've seen before, that's why movies, even with a twist, you can watch them the next time and you go, oh, now, because I know the secret, ah, now I understand this bit, now I understand that bit, now I understand that bit. That's why, you know, twist movies, you can still watch again and get more of it. And even if a movie doesn't have a twist in it, if it's just like a normal comedy, you'll pick up on different jokes on the second viewing, the third viewing, the fourth viewing. If it's like a novel with lots of depth, you know, like say something like with Dune, you'll get different things out of it each time you read it, and that relies on quality. You might not get the initial shocks or the surprises, and you might know what's happening with the twists. In this case, with the Prestige, I knew some of the twists, the twist that revealed in the movie. So, like Borden says, that the performance, even if you know the twist, even if you know the trick, it's all about the performance. And if the performance is good, it's still worth watching. Like Penn and Teller, they do the cup and balls trick, and they actually do it with clear plastic cups. So you can see every single thing that they do, but they perform it exactly the same as they just did with the metal cups that you couldn't see what was going on. So even as the twist is being revealed to you, and then you watch the cup and balls one again, you still can appreciate all of the performance and all of the misdirection and all of the clever lines and all the bits and pieces that they do there. And that's what you get with The Prestige, the novel. Let me put it this way. After watching the movie, I could still get that enjoyment out of the novel, because it is just absolutely fantastically written in a way which, as I'm reading it, I'm just going, oh, this is genius. Oh, and this is different from the movie, but it's way better than the movie. And then there's another part where I go, oh, well, this isn't, you know, he's doing something different from the movie here, and I liked this little bit of story in the movie a bit better, but this allows for this whole other dimension, you know, this, you know, the parts where, you know, real going in deep into the characters, which doesn't really happen in the movie at all, and the different dynamics between them as it goes over years and years and years of this relationship between the two of them, between these two magicians, and that's what it is. There's no secrets, or a different set of secrets now, and it's purely about the performance this time of the book. And I don't really want to get too much into it, because it's a book that I don't want to spoil, but let me just say, it's absolutely amazing. Even when I got to the end of part two, and I'd already had like one half of the story, like, or one side of the story told, I was like, oh yeah, that's it. But the rest of this story, like, because from the movie, I thought, like, well, I know it from both points of view already, but how can there be like more than half of the book left to go when I already know everything that's going to go on? I mean, how is he going to stretch this out, this other retelling now of this same story from the other side? And then as I started reading through this journal, it was definitely my favorite part of the book. You know, the first part was really clever. The framing story was, again, really, really clever and really interesting, and a lot of depth there, and really set the tone of, you know, set up the tone for the rest of the book. But then this journal part where we have Rupert on, what was his name? Robert Angier. Keep getting confused with that name. And you get his life coming from a background which hasn't got anything to do with juggling, and juggling magic. It hasn't got anything like that, and he's learning his craft, which is what brings me now onto this the part where I can really identify with it, is that if this is the first episode of this podcast that you've listened to, well, that's great, but you might not know that I'm a professional juggler. And as a professional juggler, and I perform on stage, that is my show, you know, I have an agent, all the things that goes on in this book of these guys, both of them really, who, you know, they're trying to get gigs here, they've got agents who book them here, and they get good reactions to this thing, and then they try out new stuff in the show. All of this, I recognize all of these steps and all of these different things from my own life, except for the fact that they have these trade secrets, that they had these secrets of their tricks that they don't share with other people. Juggling is the exact opposite of magic in this regards. If someone thinks you are doing a trick, they enjoy juggling less. Like, to put it this way, like, if I do a balance routine, I have to say, look, there is no trickery involved in this. There's no magic or mirrors or strings attached or anything like that. It's pure balancing skill. And then I do it, and it's good for them. You know, I don't tell people on stage that the juggling knives that I use aren't sharp. They're actually blunt, very blunt juggling knives. But again, that doesn't matter. I can just I can just get on with it, and people can just pretend like they play along in that way. I guess that's the other deception. But for the most part, all the skills that I'm doing on stage are real. There is no misdirection. When someone sees me juggling seven rings on stage, I really am juggling seven rings. And so it's not about developing the secrets, it's about developing the skills. And that's the difference. If there's a rivalry between jugglers, which it doesn't happen very often, it's really like there isn't a like who is the best. I mean, there are some jugglers, but there's no competitions, there's performance competitions, but like the idea of like who has got the best trick, it doesn't really matter, because there's not really like trade with jugglers. There's not like, there are tricks that become signature tricks of specific people, but it's more about the performance. It's more about, again, it's more about the, like you say, the linking rings thing. Like, all magicians do a linking rings thing in the same way that most jugglers do a ball act, or maybe a club act, or a ring act. And, you know, if you do comedy stuff or a street show, you'll do like something dangerous high up with audience participation. You'll get someone to throw you an object from the crowd, you know, that kind of stuff. There's like these set routines, but it's all about the performance. And no juggler is even remotely concerned if somebody else steals their trick. Where jugglers get annoyed is where if someone steals their performance idea. So, like, if someone, there's a quite a famous, within juggling, there's quite a famous routine developed by Dan Menendez where he bounces balls off a piano. It's a fake piano, like, it's just you hit the ball bounces off a key and it just hits a MIDI trigger and plays the next note. So you don't actually have to be playing the piano with the bouncing balls, but he does it and it looks really good. And then a guy called Wally Eastwood did it as well and just did a different version of it. And it's like, well, no, you didn't really come up with that idea. Even though the juggling itself is exactly the same kind of juggling, like, Dan Menendez wouldn't have a problem with this other guy just doing the same juggling tricks, but it's the idea of being like the piano juggler. And it's the same with other, I would say, like 99% of jugglers don't care if another juggler steals their trick, but they do care if the whole presentation goes with it. I'm not saying this, it's exactly the same with magic, but it's not exactly opposite with magic, but there is a big contrast there between the two. The misdirection in my show is purely not about the technical and not about the skills. It's purely about the performance. It's in the setup. If you want to look at this way, there's the setup, there's performance and the prestige. For me, the performance and the prestige, there is no misdirection, at that stage. There is no trickery at that stage. But for me, the misdirection is all in the setup. So when I introduce a routine, I'll talk about it in a way which is, you know, theatrical. I like to say theatrical. In other words, I'm lying completely when I say, back in 2005, I won the World One Diablo Championships, which is not true. Not by any stretch of the imagination can I say that, like, with a straight face. The thing is, I don't say it with a straight face. I say it once, and then I say it again. And then even before I've actually done the Diablo routine, I mention it a third time. And by the time I mention it a third time, people are laughing at it because it's just a joke. It's just, the setup is that if I'm having to, you know, if I bill myself as an award-winning juggler, and within 3 minutes I mention the same award over and over again, and it's from back in 2005, which is a long time ago, it becomes a joke. It's like a self-deprecating in that way, that I'm playing it down. And I do that throughout. You know, I talk about going to when I was training at the Moscow State Circus School, and I never trained at the Moscow State Circus School. there's just not any chance of that being true, either in my eyes. And the audience knows about this. For them, that is the magic trick. They know. And people say, oh, when you drop on stage, do you mean to do that? And I'm like, yes, of course I mean to drop on stage. That's part of the show. Like, when you drop, you pick up and you take another attempt, and then you get it on the third attempt. It's like a standard thing. And the people, like, in some ways, that's the unwritten rules. Like, in a magic show, you know you're being tricked, and you, like, if you actually learned, this is what it mentions in the prestige as well, if the audience actually knew the trick, it would kill the trick for them. They don't actually want to know the secret. They just want to be tricked. They just want to go through it and not work it out in the end. And so, you know, people say, oh, it's great. You've got this really great thing, all of those really funny situation. And she threw the ball and it hit you in the face. Oh, but you dealt with it so well. It's like, yes, when the audience member throws the ball, I actually move my head to be hit in the face every single time. That's part of the act. And all of the stuff which looks like it's happening completely spontaneously, completely ad-libbed, that's the stuff that I actually work on and practice and nerd out about in my show, to the point where, like, even if the audience wasn't there, I would still be doing the same actions, the same motion. I wouldn't be saying the same things, because what I say changes all the time, but all of the actions, all of the setup is constantly in flux. And like my girlfriend said, because we were talking about The Prestige and about how reading the book was like watching a magic trick, even if you know it, it's about watching the amazing performance of it. And she said, oh, that's what I like about your show, because she's seen my show maybe 6 or 7 times now, that even though she knows it all and she knows it's all fake, all of the audience interaction, the spontaneous audience interaction, is actually all fake, she can still enjoy it because it's still funny. And I still enjoy it because I still find it funny. I don't do anything on stage unless I find it clever or interesting or entertaining or funny in some way, or impressive. If it's a juggling trick, if I can impress myself, I think I'm impressing other people. What else have I got here? So, I've got a note here that says, becoming a magician juggler, what do you work on? I guess it comes down to the performance. You know, there's a lot of this in The Prestige about people going, oh yes, and I went to my workshop and I trained on this and I worked for this and I set aside 2 hours every morning and 2 hours every afternoon and an hour again in the evening to work on this. And when I was first becoming a juggler, I was doing the same thing. You know, I juggled like 5, 6, 7 hours a day in some case, 3 hour juggling sessions. I still do now, but I kind of like do a little bit more focused stuff. Although now I do have, like the guys like the magicians in this novel, I do have my own juggling workshop at home. What else have I got here? Another one. He mentions, like, I spent a year in London, and after a year of London of working, I managed to do one gig, and in that one gig, I made, you know, 3 shillings. And that was it for my entire year. And then the end of the next year is like, this year I made £80. And he's like, ooh. And then the next year I made £300. Ooh. And then by the end of it, he goes, right, I'm not, this year I made £10,000. And I'm not going to mention it anymore. And this is something that is a bit strange. When I quit my previous job to become a professional juggler, long before that, I my first ever gigs when I was young, when I was maybe, 16, 17, when I first did, you know, I did some street show stuff, and I remember going out for the first time and doing my first street show, and it was terrible. Everyone's first street show is terrible. And then I went out and did some other things, and I got some contracts with people, and I remember my first gig, I got £25 by the council, and then the next one, I got £75, and then, you know, I got £300, and I was like, oh, £300 for a gig, that's really great. And it, you know, I would have the same kind of track, you know, that first year of doing anything, you're going to be not just really shit, but you're not going to make any money. And if you do make any money, it's like, it's not going to be worth anything. I say worth anything. It's not going to, you're not ever going to be able to rely on that. You've got to have other kinds of means. And now with my juggling, I earn, you know, I'm at that point where I don't need to go, oh, this year I earned this much. You know, I'm just very comfortable. I earn a lot more money than I ever need to spend. And there's no problem. There's no problems with that. I actually take less work than I could do just because I just don't need it. You know, I don't need the money. I'm just, I always end the year with a lot more money in my bank than I did at the beginning. And that's great. There's no problem at all. But now I'm going through the same kind of process, like with my fiction, even though I'm not wanting to make any money with my fiction that I'm publishing, it's like, oh, someone sent me £20 on PayPal, no, $20 on PayPal because they enjoyed it. Someone else sent me $5 on PayPal. I was like, oh, this is really clever. This is really good. I'm making a little bit of money. And again, with the podcast, with the, with the Audible sponsorship that I'm doing, it's not, you know, I'm not doing the Audible sponsorship to, you know, to make a living. It's more of a way that, listeners to this, SFBRP listeners, they can get like free audiobooks, they can get a good deal, and in the same way, they can show support to the podcast in that way, because lots of people over the years have asked me, well, how can I show support? And now I was like, well, you know, Audible is great, you can do it in that way. and I get money and you get a good deal and things. And also with music at the moment, I'm doing more and more music stuff. I'm writing and performing more music and performing in comedy shows. And, you know, I'm getting like not professional gigs, but I'm getting bookings in Berlin, not for any juggling. Nobody there knows that I'm a juggler, or if they do, you know, that's a kind of secondary. They just see me as a musician and comedian who combines the music and comedy and sings, interesting songs in that way. And in 2012, I made about, I think, 35 euros from two gigs that I did. And it's really interesting to be at these different stages in my life. And then, like I say, reading this novel, The Prestige, and seeing this game kind of thing is like, yes, this year I made this much money. And using that as like a, like, well, how good am I? Well, how much money am I making? What is my, you know, what is my prestige in the juggling world? What is my prestige in the magical world? And that's a really great thing that I say I noticed in this book. And what's the other thing I said? Oh yeah, yeah. Also, with the idea of like the two people in the two magicians in this novel, one of them finds the magic really easy, but the performance more difficult. And but is still, you know, a good businessman and just does well at that way. The other guy is the opposite way around. He's really bad at working out the magic, and he can't design a trick at all. It's just, there's just no way for him to do this by himself. So he has to employ people to make his magic. He has to buy the magic books to learn all of this kind of stuff. And the other guy, you know, the opposite. He instinctively knows the magic, but the performance comes hard. Whereas the other magician, he's very bad at thinking magically, but he's got very good performance skills, or that seems to be the thing that sets him apart, that's the part that comes instinctively to him, even though his magic is the difficult part. And I've seen the same kind of thing as a guest entertainer, who's someone who works on cruise ships with my own show. There's lots of other entertainers on the ship, on different ships, and they, like some musicians or singers, and they don't have their own solo show, but they want to put one together. And lots of them come up to me, or over the years, a lot of different entertainers have come up to me, and they're like a musician in a band, but they want their own show. They say, okay, what advice can you give me, you know, about getting an agent, or what advice can you give me about putting together a show? And I remember there was these two guys from this same quartet, the same a cappella quartet, and they both came up to me like on the same cruise and asked me advice. And one of them was like, okay, what do I do about business stuff? What do I do about getting an agent? What do I do about money and all these other kind of things? And I said, well, what about your show? He's like, oh, a show, I can do a show, no problem. You know, I can get the sheet music, put together a set. You know, that's no problem. I'm a good performer, no problem at all. And then another guy from the same group comes up to me and says, oh, what do I do? I need to put together a show. I need to put together a set list. I need to work out the music, you know, what am I going to wear and all the stuff that was on stage. And I said, well, yeah, that's, I'll talk to you about that. But what about the business side? And he's like, oh, the business side is easy. Oh, no, I'll be able to get an agent, no problem at all. And it was really funny that these two guys, you just think, wait, why don't you guys just work together, like help each other out? One of you help the other guy with the show, and the other guy help, you know, with the other one help you with the business. And that really came home to me reading this book, because these guys have got this feud going on. They never talk. And at the end, I think pretty much both of the stories, they both go, oh man, this feud this obsession was just consuming our lives, and it would have been so much better if we'd have worked together rather than been constant rivals. And I think at the end of it, they both came to that conclusion. And I think in the frame story, they came to that conclusion. That's not really a spoiler, that they both regret their actions all the way through in some ways, and want to turn back, but they seemed like kind of fate is pulling them through this thing, and their ancestors as well. You think, well, who is my rival? Maybe my rival is my rival because I have something that they need, and maybe they have something that I need. Maybe we could get together in this way, and that's what I've had with previous partners, I'd say partners, like girlfriends, sometimes you go, oh, actually what I need is this. And I've realized that until I was with that person, or maybe in an artistic collaboration, that's what I actually needed. And there's no need to fear any kind of rivalry between two people. Because obviously with these two magicians, the magic world was big enough for them both. Because it obviously was big enough for them both. It wasn't a zero-sum game. They could have, you know, they could have helped each other out a lot. One with the performance and the other one with the technical side. And that's what you get. And anyway, my last note was, do I have a nemesis? And I realize I don't actually have a nemesis. The people that I could be my nemesis, I have in the past always reached out to help. And I'm much more of a make friends with my nemesis kind of person. There was, I guess, my twin brother. He could be called my evil twin. But then again, I am the evil twin with me and my brother, I guess, is one way to look at it. And I've had some rivalries in juggling over the years, but it's, you know, nothing ever serious or anything like that. And then I guess the only one, which is not really a nemesis, but a long term, when there was a friend of mine, before he was a friend of mine, I was confused for him because his name was Luke and my name was Luke. I'm Luke Burridge. He's Luke Wilson. And yes, that we were both English jugglers. And then Luke moved to Germany. And then later I moved to Germany and he had a German girlfriend and then a wife. And I had a German girlfriend and we both performed, you know, not the same kind of stuff, but similar kind of stuff. And we both, you know, English jugglers called Luke living in Germany. And many people would say, oh, are you Luke? And I'm like, yes, Luke Wilson. I'm like, no, I'm the other Luke. And I know he had the same kind of thing going on there. And not so much a rivalry, but it was one of those things. Unfortunately, Luke Wilson died in September of throat cancer. And it was one of those things that I just posted on Facebook. I said, oh, there was only ever one Luke. And it's so true in that way that it could have been, I wouldn't say it could have been a rivalry, because there was no question of ever being a rivalry, but that like friendly rivalry between us, which was never serious, but like it was publicly acknowledged, but never serious in a way. And he was 4 years older than me, and always a little, you know, a few steps ahead of me in terms of juggling career, even though we were doing, you know, different things. Again, I wrote about him on my blog after, you know, a few days after he died, to kind of get that sorted out. And if you want to read more about it there, you can. But it is one of those things that, like, after Luke Wilson died, I realized that no, we were similar in so many ways, but the evil nemesis idea, the rivals, it was never there. Even though, like I say, publicly acknowledged, but it was all a joke. Anyway, I think that's all I have to say about this. For me, The Prestige was, as you can tell, a very, very clever book. It was fantastically written. The stories were really great. The interplay was amazing. And as you can see from the last hour that I've been talking about this, very personal to me in many ways. And if you've seen the movie, and if you've read the book, and if you know anything about being a professional entertainer, a variety entertainer, I think this you'll understand how much I enjoyed this book on so many different levels there. Finally, I just wanted to say that finishing off here, I did listen to this via the Audible book. It's the Blackstone Audio, narrated by Simon Vance. And I really love Simon Vance's performances, because he does have to do first person narration for four or five different characters that he's doing first person narration for. He does it very, very well. The modern day characters feel very modern, and then the Victorian style, obviously reading this like kind of Victorian English that he's reading there, again, very interesting, the ways that he sets that up. And also the way that there's the different magicians, he gives them different voices, which is great. But also the diary of one of them begins when he is, I think, 14 years old and continues through to when he's in his mid 40s. And it's like a masterclass of like, okay, how do you do a young person's voice? And then he, you know, the diary skips forward a year, and then he does another one, and then the diary skips forward another year, and you realize, oh, Simon Vance, as the narrator, he's changing his voice. The 17-year-old character has got a different voice from the 18-year-old character, has got a different voice than the 21-year-old character, has got a different voice from the 25-year-old character. And then you skip ahead to when he's 30, he's got a different voice again. And, like, just the weariness in his voice as he grows older is amazing. And especially because the writer, the magician who's talking about then is like, yes, and when I was on stage, I was pretending to be tired. And I was feeling really tired, but I was pretending to be not tired. You know, he's like in his different emotional states on stage, and yet he's doing an act on top of that. And Simon Vance brings that across, not just in when he's quoting the guy on stage, but kind of where he is at that point in the memoir, or where he is at that point in the narration, in the story. He brings into these different effects into it, which again is really great misdirection itself on another layer, on top of the story, on top of the writing style, on top of all of the ideas of magic tricks going on top of the twists. The narration brings a whole other level to that as well. It's a short book, 12 hours, 19 minutes. I think it's like 300 pages. Let me just click on the Goodreads thing here. It says, yes. Oh, 404 pages. It's the perfect length of a book here. It's got some really good stuff, and it might not sound like there's any science fiction or fantasy or any elements in this. There really is, but I don't want to give away exactly what's going on until you've seen the movie, and then in the book has got different elements in there. So I don't want to say if it's which one has got more science fiction or fantasy elements in there, but, you know, it's a book about magicians, so I'm going to leave it up to you to decide which way this goes. Yes, and because I just mentioned the Audible book, I will mention that if you want a free subscription or a free 1 month subscription, which is you can actually download an audiobook for free from Audible. If you go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP, you can in that way support the podcast. You can have access to over 100,000 different audiobooks. I do recommend The Prestige. It's a really great audiobook. The performance is fantastic by Simon Vance, and it's a really great book. So if you want to help support the SFBRP, help support my Audible subscription, you can check that out. And like I say, but in doing that, you can get a free audiobook. So if you've never tried Audible, The Prestige is a really good place to start. And yes, audibletrial.com/SFBRP. And so in conclusion, I'm going to give this book 5 stars. I think this was 2 5-star books this year. I'm not entirely sure. I know it's very rare that I think this is the 4th book now that I've given 5 stars to in the 5 years of doing this podcast. So it doesn't come along very often. And yet again, it's a book which is very personal to me, which makes me brings up all these different emotions, which is almost impossible in other ways. And yet the science fiction / fantasy elements of it it's pitched at a perfect level for me. I understand if other people don't like this so much, and I understand if people watch the movie and are like, oh, I didn't really like it. But hopefully I've explained why I find this book amazing, and hopefully I've done it. And this is the big challenge. Hopefully I've done it without any spoilers. Now, I've been going just about an hour, so to finish up, I'll just like to say, if you're interested in my own writing on my blog, you can check it out at lukeburge.com/blog. My own fiction is on there as well. If you want to read my novels and novellas, you can check out lukeburge.com. Click on the fiction there. And follow me on Twitter. I'm Luke Burridge on Twitter, and also check out sfbrp.com. And if you want to see the other books that I've rated so highly, you can check out the episode lists there. There's lots of there's 3 different lists of, you know, all of the books that I've reviewed so far by episode number, by star rating, and by author. So you can check it out. And talking of Christopher Priest, I do have Inverted World, I think is another one of his novels, and I downloaded it, or maybe I just added that to my wish list on Audible, but I will be reading that in the future, because if it's anything near as good as this, I'll find it amazing. And finally, on goodreads.com, you can become my friend, and I can see what you thought of this book. For example, Joel rated it 4 stars, Sandy rated it 2 stars, if you've seen the movie, don't bother with the book. Usually I don't mind spoilers, because the journey is why I read or watch a movie. In this case, the spoiled reveal spoiled the book. I don't think so. I think it's the other way around. I think even if you've watched the movie, but if you really don't want anything spoiled, just read the book, because it will be a better experience for it if you haven't seen the movie. I'm just saying, if you're going to watch the movie first, then read the book. But the perfect way to do it would be to read the book first. Yeah, it doesn't have a 3.545 average for friends reviews and 3.82 average for normal people. But like I say, for me, it was a highly personal book with all the kind of stuff that I do want from fiction and from science fiction and fantasy, all in one package. And like I say, I understand if other people don't enjoy it in the same way, but this book, in a way, is a glimpse into my life in a way which was surprising to me. Not into my life exactly, but into the world of being a performer and things in a way that I just wasn't expecting. Okay, that's it from me. Thanks a lot for listening. Also email me, luke@juggler.net, if you've got any other feedback or if you want to suggest a book. I do try to reply to every single email that I get in. So yeah, email me there. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.